Coming up in the show, we got Jason Timpf talking about some early season trends in the NBA, and then Jeff Goodman previewing college basketball prospects to watch because the season's starting today. Let's get into it. All right, joining me now to talk some NBA from Hoops Tonight, Jason Timpf. Jason, how are you?
I'm doing good, man. The first couple weeks of the season are always a bit of a shock after a slow summer, but I feel like I'm starting to get my legs underneath me. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing excellent, man. It's been a fun start to the year, and I feel like we're starting to get a rhythm here with figuring out what's real, what's not, and everything like that. And so to discuss a lot of stuff happening around the NBA today, we're going to play a game. We're going to have three categories for you that you're going to choose from: panic or patience, the lineup lab, and small sample theater. Those are our three categories for everything going on around the NBA right now, Jason. Where do you want to start? Panic or patience, the lineup lab, or small sample theater?
Let's start small sample theater.
Okay, small sample theater. We will start right there then. Okay, on Sunday night, we saw the San Antonio Spurs finally lose a game. They lost their first time of the entire season to the Phoenix Suns, who beat them 130 to 118 in the game. And the Suns, they held Victor Wembanyama to only 9 points on 4 of 14 from the floor. He had 2 assists to 6 turnovers in that entire game. And ultimately, the main thing we saw in this game, Jason, was a lot of double teams against Victor Wembanyama. The Suns threw two at him better than anybody has this entire season so far. And we've seen, you know, Dallas tried it on opening night. We've seen the Nets try it. Nobody did it better than the Suns did with the pressure against Victor, and the Spurs performed quite poorly in this game. And so this is leading me to my question for you here, because with Victor this season, he's experienced so many double teams. When he faces single coverage, Victor Wembanyama and the Spurs are scoring 1.01 points per play out of isolations and post-ups. He turns the ball over only 5.9% of the time when he faces single coverage. Against double teams, 17 plays total, he's been doubled. The Spurs have scored only 8 points, so 0.47 points per play, with a 17.6% turnover percentage. I would imagine the Suns showed a formula that we're going to see a lot of moving forward this season. What's your read on what we saw in that Sunday night game between the Suns and the Spurs? And do you think this is going to be something we see against San Antonio and Victor a lot more moving forward this year?
Almost certainly. I don't think it'll look as bad as it did last night. Like, there was some stuff with Wemby last night that was kind of reminiscent of his rookie year, like him kind of getting dislodged off of his base and fumbling the basketball away, trying to dribble through traffic, seemingly just struggling with physicality, which is something that to start this year, it just hasn't been an issue, right? So I think some of it was like Wemby played a really bad game too. But the issue that you're calling attention to, I think, is significant in the sense that this is going to be the way that most teams will decide to guard San Antonio. And when they do, it'll highlight one of his biggest, or one of this roster's individual weaknesses, which is shooting the basketball, right? So they actually have been decent off the catch to start the season before last night, better than you would have expected. But last night, just 0.69 points per catch and shoot jump shot. That's obviously not going to get the job done when you're double teaming your best player, right? So I think it's going to be one of those things where, as a team, the Spurs are going to have to figure out how to address this specific issue. How are we going to score when Wemby has the basketball and he's getting double teamed? I think the Dylan Harper going down with the calf injury was kind of an issue too, because him and his ability to cut an offensive rebound has been super helpful for them in their spacing. Steph Castle's a guy who can do a lot of work in the middle of the floor off of Wemby as a cutter. Keldon Johnson as well. They can get more stuff that doesn't necessarily involve catch and shoot shooting. I think the bigger issue though that I kind of noticed from last night was ironically their defense. It's one of those things where even in the early part of the season when their schedule was pretty easy, they were still a mediocre half-court offense. I think they were like 14th or 15th in the league on cleaning the glass before last night's game. But they were just so good on defense and so good on the defensive glass and so good in transition that they were scoring extremely well. And last night, the Suns, this is actually an insane stat, the Suns per catch and shoot jump shot last night, 2.11 points per attempt. So when Phoenix is going to shoot the ball that well, now they're not getting those long rebounds and those defensive rebounds opportunities to run. And so like that kind of just shined an even bigger light on their half court execution, which obviously was so brutal with their catch and shoot shooting and the turnovers that it just kind of looked, let me just refine it to say, this is the most exaggerated version of what it will look like. But I do think this will be a recurring issue throughout the season for them.
Totally. I mean, I think it's going to be very fascinating to see how much we see it, because like with Jokic, for example, when you double team Jokic, he shreds you. Like you almost are better off playing single coverage sometimes. Giannis is facing a lot of double coverage. Zion, like there's a number of great players that are facing a lot of single coverage. So with San Antonio, this split is extreme. Like, I don't think it's going to be 0.47 points per isolation or post up when the ball is in Victor's hands the whole season. Like, that's just crazy. If a couple of threes are hit out of those double teams, sometimes triple teams, that number inflates a lot. This is why it's small sample theater here. However, I do think we're going to see probably teams increase the frequency in which they do it. I mean, until the Spurs do start hitting those threes you're talking about, until it starts actually happening, you're going to see teams say, we're not going to let Victor Wembanyama shoot 60% and dominate from the post and ISO. We're going to force the ball out of his hands as much as possible and force Keldon Johnson to beat us, like Jordan McLaughlin, like De'Aaron Fox, once he's back eventually. Like, that's what teams are going to decide to do. A De'Aaron Fox spot up three, or Victor Wembanyama facing up, attacking the basket. That will have to be the equation at times for these teams. But ultimately, if I'm the Spurs, I'm not like overreacting yet, but I do think it does touch on your overall point here with the lack of shooting. But the turnover number that's in there, though, Jason, you know, 17.6% of those possessions were turned over to 5.9% against single coverage. I think that does touch on one of the things that we've seen teams also try against Victor, is putting a smaller guy on him. What are your thoughts on that strategy that we've seen teams try against Victor?
In general, I think that's what you have to do. I think we've seen, I thought the Dallas game was the most resounding example of this, but if you put a bigger bodied center against Wemby, he is both bigger and faster than them. It's just an absolute recipe. It's such a recipe for disaster. But like, you know, seeing a lot of like the Oso Iguodaro type, the Royce O'Neal type, just like that kind of shorter, more like stocky athlete up underneath him, it tests that base that we were talking about earlier. And that's the interesting part. Like when I look at the double teams in particular, the turnovers, there's a couple of different ways that they're coming, but one of the most significant ways is just literally attacking his base and he's losing the basketball in traffic. The cross court passes, they're getting up underneath him and disrupting his base so that when he goes to throw the cross court pass, it's looping, it's way too high, it's giving the defense a chance to rotate. And that's why I think like we've seen it work on a couple of occasions this season, but I'd like to see him get the ball more to the middle of the floor out of those double teams. So like a flash from the weak side or a cut right off of the slot there with someone relocating to that strong side wing, making that passing read for Wemby quicker and shorter so that it's something that they can get the ball out quickly and play a little bit of 4-on-3 rather than asking Wemby to basically like retreat against a little guy and go like way over his head to throw some cross court pass that has almost no chance of hitting the shooter in the pocket.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's spot on, Jason. Let's move on to the next one in our small sample theater here. Ryan Rollins and the Milwaukee Bucks. He's out off to an outstanding start to this season, basically tripling all of his numbers so far from what we saw last year. Last season, he averaged 6.2 points per game in 14.6 minutes per game. Well, that's up 18.2 points per game and double the minutes, 32 minutes per game. His efficiency is up from 60% true shooting to 65.3%. He's not turning the ball over. He's distributing out of pick and rolls. He's near the tops of the NBA in pick and roll efficiency. Ryan Rollins, Jason, is Ryan Rollins for real?
I think so. I mean, whether or not he's going to be like some all-star level 20 point per game guy, it's certainly way too soon to tell. But like, even before these recent two back-to-back career high games that he had, I, in the early part of the season, was really impressed with just the natural kind of give and take he had with Giannis, where he was finding his opportunities to be aggressive in pick and roll, but not really stepping on Giannis's toes and kind of disrupting Giannis's rhythm. He just kind of looked like a guy that was slotting into basically doing a better job of what Kevin Porter Jr. was doing at the tail end of last year. And, you know, the couple of big things that stand out, it's a lot to the basket where he's being way more efficient than most guards are. He's kind of bigger and more physical than you'd think for a guard. He gets into your body well and gets his arms out and finishes in traffic well. And then he's already hit more pull-up threes than he hit the entirety of last season. So that's the counter to that little bit of downhill force. And then for a guy who doesn't really have a lot of ball handling reps at the NBA level, he's been really good with his kickout reads. I think one of the sneaky kind of like fun parts of this season for the Bucks is shifting a lot of Damian Lillard's minutes and a lot of, you know, lesser athletes to guys like Ryan Rollins that are bigger, more athletic, that pressure the rim. That Cole Anthony too, I think, has brought a good amount of this, where he's like just been downhill and making kickout reads and they're surrounding him with shooting. And so it just kind of works in the sense that this, if you look at this roster on paper, for them to be, what are they, fourth in offensive rating, I think is a testament to just how complimentary all these guys are. Giannis has obviously been amazing. Ryan has just blossomed into this legitimate secondary ball handler. And then you've got him surrounded by shooting and a couple of other dudes who can pressure the rim. It just kind of makes sense in modern basketball. And with Ryan, obviously, whether or not he becomes more of that all-star fringe, all-star level handler in the long run, a guy who can average, you know, 20 points per game, is going to come down to this kind of stuff he was doing against Golden State, hitting some of those tougher pull-up threes, that big mid-range jump shot he hit off of the left elbow extended one-on-one late in the game where he just gets downhill and it pops right left off the floor, knocks it down. Like, that higher level, almost Devin Booker-esque shot making will be the ceiling raiser for him. But just his ability to get to the basket and finish, hit a three when a guy goes under or dies on the screen, and make the pick and roll reads while also being a much bigger athlete than Damian Lillard on the other side of the floor, mm-hmm. has like kind of fundamentally altered this team. This is a way more physically imposing Bucks team. That Jalen, the game they beat the Knicks, Ryan Rollins was doing a great job on Jalen Brunson down the stretch of that game. Got a big steal on him and forced him into an air ball late. Like, he's just a more dynamic athlete on both ends of the floor than Dame was.
It sounds outrageous to say, but it is crazy just how much better it feels with Ryan Rollins than Damian Lillard, because of the two-way ability, to your point. It's not just the offense that Ryan Rollins is performing with right now, it's defense as well. And it's just like with Dame, it just was made out to be, and we all thought, or most people thought, it would be Giannis and Dame, this amazing combination, unstoppable in the pick and roll. Well, it never was. And it already looks like they have better chemistry with Rollins and Giannis, and Rollins and Turner look good. They're using Kuzma as a screener sometimes as well. Like, every combination with Ryan Rollins is excelling. And ultimately with the Bucks, before the season started, in my predictions I wrote about on Yahoo Sports, was about, one of them was with the Bucks. I said the Giannis trade rumors are going to die. I said the Bucks are going to be too good. We're not going to hear about it until the summer, if that. We might never hear it again. It might be dead for good. With the Bucks, so far this season, they're 4-2. They lost over the weekend to the Kings on Saturday night by 2 points, 135-133. But they're 4-2. They beat the Warriors. They beat the Knicks. They've had some good performances so far this year. I'm a little bit surprised to still see them fourth in championship odds. Maybe it's too early to see big swings here, Jason, but
they're fourth in championship odds right now.
Fourth in the East.
I was gonna say
fourth in the East, behind the Cavs, who are heavy favorites at +200, then the Knicks, then the Magic, still ahead of the Bucks. So maybe it's too early for these things to change, but I just think like they have the best player in the Eastern Conference with a really good supporting roster around him. It's wide open in the East. Maybe I'm weighting Giannis's presence too much, but I look at this roster and I love what I see around Giannis, and I feel like this team does have a chance to represent the East in the NBA Finals. I feel like +1100 odds or whatever it is this morning, I think it's a little it's not high enough. It should be more like +600, third best in the East or something like that. But this team has a real shot, in my opinion, man. I know it's early.
It's super complimentary. Like, it just. it's crazy to think last year, like going, look at the main lineup that we saw most of last year, where it's like Dame, Gary Trent, Torian Prince, Giannis, and Brooke. It's like Miles is a much better athlete than Brooke. AJ Green
changes
is a much
everything.
Quicker player everything. Than AJ Green's a much quicker and smarter defender than Torian Prince is. Torian Prince back in the day maybe, but like he's just so slow. I don't really trust him guarding opposing guards. And then going from Dame to Ryan Rollins, they are fundamentally different athletically, fundamentally different, and they look much closer to obviously Sacramento game notwithstanding. That was kind of a letdown, I thought, and They just really struggled to guard him in that particular game.
They should have smacked him, Jason.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, like, absolutely.
I thought we'd be entering this show Bucks 5-1 today after, you know, beating the Kings, who have not been good this season at all. But like that is a disappointment. So like I say all that, and yet I understand when they do need to prove it over time.
And they could have won that game too. Like, I mean, like there was a couple of questionable calls late. There was the DeRozan spinning into the lane. There was the play where Miles Turner stripped. I think it's kind of a BS sequence where Miles strips Zach LaVine clean and gets called for a foul. And then Giannis gets the same call on the final. Yeah, but it is what it is. But they lose. It's more just looking big picture at the team. They're fundamentally different athletically. Kudos to Doc Rivers too. He's playing the right guys. He's kind of like putting them in the right spots. And it kind of reminds me of the 2018 Cavs in the sense that it's like Giannis surrounded by shooting, and they're just athletic and physical enough to be able to get enough stops. And that just makes them a puncher's chance in an Eastern Conference where, as long as Darius Garland isn't healthy, even the Cavs are vulnerable. And so every team in that conference is vulnerable. So I could easily talk myself into them winning the conference.
Yeah, without a doubt. Like you said, Doc Rivers has been great so far this season. Again, Kings game notwithstanding. Ultimately, I mean, like 1 year ago, there were the rumors about Brook Lopez leaving to go to Houston. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, rumblings that the Bucks actually wanted to modernize their team. Well, Miles Turner has done a lot of that. And the Bucks look a lot different. They've shifted their identity entirely, and it looks excellent. Let's move on to our last of the three small sample theater topics, and that is the Oklahoma City Thunder. There is one undefeated team remaining. That's the 7-0 Thunder. Last season, they win 68 games, 12.7 net rating. They go on to win the NBA Finals. So far this season, they have a 13.1 net rating. They have the number one defensive rating again. Last year, the defensive rating was 7 points per 100 possessions, better than the league average. So far this year, number one defensive rating is 10.7 points per 100 possessions, better than the league average D rating. And this is all without Jalen Williams. Everything without Jalen Williams so far this season. So, Jason, are the Thunder even better than they were last year?
I think that was a given coming into the season, and it certainly has been the case to start. I mean, you have to factor, like you mentioned, J-Dub, Chet's been out the last three games. Mind you, it's been a really light schedule that they've played over that specific stretch. But like the biggest thing that stands out to me is they kind of are like, they're grinding out wins in like close games that are ugly, like they did early in the season against Indiana and against Houston. It's very much a veteran basketball team kind of thing. With Chet being out, and with J-Dub being out, it's put extra pressure on Shea on offense, and I think he's been fantastic. I think we've seen really impressive stuff from A.J. Mitchell and Aaron Wiggins bringing additional offense. I think Isaiah Joe being back has been crucial for them, just because like there was a stretch there where you're watching them in the first couple of games where you're like, man, you take J-Dub out and there's just not a lot of offensive skill on this roster.
Two double overtime games to start the year.
Yeah, exactly. But like to their credit, like they've been just getting enough from those other three guys that I just mentioned. Shea, I think, has been fantastic, especially late in games early in the season. And so this is like, it's all the classic stuff with OKC, right? Like defense to transition, getting a ton of points off of turnovers, ball pressuring like crazy. Like Lu Dort shot the ball like crap to start the year, but I thought he did an unbelievable job defensively on Kevin Durant and on Pascal Siakam in both of those games. Like there's a consistency with their baseline foundation of being just this butt kicking physical perimeter defense that forces a bunch of turnovers. But Shea, I think, looks better than he did last year. You're getting offensive contributions from some guys further down the roster, and reinforcements are on the way. Like they are going to get J-Dub back. They are going to get Chet back. Like they were a safe bet to win, you know, at a minimum 60 games this year. But like, I legitimately think 70 is on the table. Like, this team is that kind of special.
Wow. So you think 70 is on the table with them? And I would too. I believe that there's a real chance of that. But this team is special, and it's because they have so many lanes to be better. Like, all their youth. This is not an old team that won 68 games and won the NBA Finals. It's one of the youngest teams in NBA history that won the Finals. And so these young guys can get better. And so this next week, Jason, they have four games starting on Tuesday against the Clippers. It's a road trip, four-game road trip at Clippers, at Blazers, at Kings, at Grizzlies. Are they 11-0 in a week?
The Grizzlies... The Grizzlies are on the way down. I'm sure we're going to talk about them later today. Yep. The Kings, I have not been high on them at all, even after the Milwaukee win. But that said, Portland is a team I have a healthy amount of respect for. They are very big, very athletic on the perimeter. They have rim protection. The Clippers are starting to play a little bit better. So, like, I think 3-1 in that trip would be a huge win for them.
Which one do you think they lose of the four? Which one are they going to drop?
I'm going to go with they drop the game to the Clippers. That's tough, because even Portland, Denny's playing super well, and he's too big for some of their guards. Although I think Dort will present some problems for him. They're going to drop one of those two. I'm going to go with they drop the Clippers game. What do you think?
I think they're going to be 11-0 in a week, and they're going to be entering next week. They face the Warriors and the Lakers on back-to-back nights. I think one of those or both of those are on national TV. And so they're going to be 11-0 entering Warriors and Lakers back-to-back. And it's going to be a big thing. And we'll be right back after this break. Just a heads up that it's not too late to sign up for Yahoo's newest fantasy basketball format, High Score. It's a clean, simplified, brand new format where you draft 10 players, you start six, and then you set your lineup only once per week. It takes only your starters' best single games from the week, and then you go head-to-head against your opponents in the league. And so with the NBA, it's still early. Draft a team on High Score today in the Yahoo Fantasy app or on yahoofantasy.com. All right, our other two categories, the lineup lab and panic or patience. Where do you want to go next?
Let's do panic or patience.
Okay, panic or patience. Well, where else could we start but with Ja Morant, the Memphis Grizzlies. So Ja Morant, over the weekend, Shams Charania drops the news that he was suspended for conduct detrimental to the team. That's because in a loss on Friday, he quit. He quit. So just straight up quit. In the second half of the game, was not moving when he didn't have the ball in his hands, wasn't putting an effort on defense. After the game, something must have happened specifically with him and their Grizzlies head coach, and they decided to suspend him for a game. And so with Ja Morant, we are in a situation now, Jason, where I have, throughout the year, earlier in the year, I did my top 50 rankings. I had Ja Morant outside of the top 40. A lot of people on social media, particularly the Ja stans, as insane as they are, got very, very angry with me. And I reiterated that again. What happened in that game on Friday and what his diminishing performance is why I have him outside of the top 40. And I put out some stats on social media about his at-rim frequency by season in his NBA career as a rookie. 49% of his shot attempts were at the rim. This season, as of that night, it was 28%. Now it's down to 25%. So it's pretty much been cut in half, the frequency in which he's getting to the basket. And the problem is, Jason, he's also not improving as a shooter. This year, he has taken 32 three-pointers. He's made 5 of them. Guess how many air balls Ja Morant has of those 32 three-pointers?
I saw a couple of them the other night. So. Already just a half dozen? How many?
He's got 5 air balls, man. 5 made threes. The shot does not look good at all. He looks like a player who has regressed. And so, I bring that to the question here. The state of Ja Morant and the Grizzlies, Jason. Are you panicking or are you staying patient?
I have been more or less of the opinion that the Grizzlies need to move on from the Ja Morant era for a little over a year now. I think there's above and beyond even his, there's the conversation about him in his career trajectory, which I think you laid out perfectly. A lot of similar stuff that I was going to hit on, like the jump shooting continues to get worse. I've listed his synergy shot attempts at the rim. He's decreased every single year since he made the All-NBA team, and he's literally at 4.7 attempts per game at the rim per synergy to start this season when he was 9.6 in 2022 when he made All-NBA, which is literally less than half. So he's he's getting to the rim less than half as frequently as he did, as you put in that chart, that great visual representation. Like
the raw numbers are crazy to hear, Jason. Like the percentages I had on screen, but the raw only less than five times total per game blows my mind.
Yeah,
and one of the responses people had to that chart on social was like, "Well, 28% is still good." It's like, well, it's slightly above average for a point guard, but if you look at like these other great athletic guards, like Russell Westbrook was above 40% every year of his career. It never went down when he was just in his mid-20s. It stayed up. And so that's where it's like, this is concerning with Ja. The shot's not going to improve, but he's also not getting to the rim as much. He talked last year about not dunking anymore. Like, that's scary. It's really scary when you project him forward.
Exactly. And like, I don't think it's quite as bad as the numbers show in the sense that he's also clearly not being as aggressive to start the season to the rim. So like, do I think he's the same guy who got to the rim 10 times a game back in 2022? Obviously not. He's clearly declining, but it's also being exacerbated by his attitude and total level of engagement. And so when you put that in conjunction with the poor jump shooting, and then also like the last part of it too is like this roster. Like if I asked you in a vacuum, like, okay, we have this guy in Ja Morant. He's got this transcendently great foundational gift. It's the thing that has had me so excited about Ja forever and why it's hard to give up on him, which is he's incredibly good at getting to the rim and he's a very good short range shot maker. Like when he pops up off the ground, kind of like the Suns game winner, when he pops up off the ground in that 5 to 8 foot range and he shoots that little push shot, he hits it at an extremely high rate. As a matter of fact, I think he's 12 for 17 on floaters this season. He's great at that shot and he's great at getting to the rim, theoretically, right? Obviously not in practice to start this year. And so, I also think he's a great passer. I think he's a much better passer than people give him credit for. So like, if you asked me what kind of roster he should be on, I would tell you he needs to be on a team that can space the floor. And this Memphis Grizzlies team has been the worst jump shooting team in the entire NBA to start the season. Even if you take out the Ja Morant pull-up jump shots and you focus more on catch and shoots, they're still one of the worst teams in the league at converting catch and shoot jump shots. And so it's kind of, in addition to any in a vacuum concerns you have about Ja Morant, it's also a roster that is not suited for his strengths. Teams are going to pack the paint against Ja, just like the Lakers did. That is going to be the game plan. And that then accentuates his biggest weakness, which is he has never improved as a jump shooter. And then the last thing I'll say about it is this. If you're the Grizzlies, has this guy at any point shown any attempt to accept personal responsibility for what's going on or any self-awareness to what's going on around him? And that's the hard part. When there's absolutely no positive trajectory in him as a basketball player, in fact, a negative trajectory, and there's also a lack of self-awareness and accepting personal responsibility, it's just like, to me, the giant red flag of all red flags to say that this is not the right situation for him to be in. And it gets confusing because like I start to think, I go like, okay, well, what kind of team makes sense for Ja? And I think about teams, like, it'd be fun if like Boston made a move for a guy like Ja because they can surround him with shooting. But it's like, why would Boston want him? Why would Boston want him with everything that's gone on with him and his personality over the last couple of years? And so it's just a sad story because like, again, I really do think he had a superstar foundational trait. The ability to get to the rim basically against anybody and the ability to make short range shots and play make out of those situations. And it's just been an incredible underachievement to this point.
It's a shame because that series he had against the Warriors where he was just absolutely unstoppable. Those highs were unbelievable. He was one of the funnest players in the entire NBA to watch. And he was also dominant. And ever since then, we just have not seen that version of Ja. And to your point about the personality aspect, that's what made the quotes after the game just so alarming. I mean, like he's asked about what happened in the second half. Ask the coaching staff. You're the guy who quit on the freaking team. I mean, you're the leader. You're supposed to be the leader of the team. That's not how a leader has responded. And it's not the first time he's acted that way. Ultimately, if the play on the court were still at the level that it was in his prime, it'd be forgivable. You'd just say, well, that's just part of Ja. But it's not. And so that's where you look at the Grizzlies. Like, I'm slamming the panic button here with Memphis. I'm panicked because, like, this window very well could be shut. I think it is shut. They may not realize it yet, but I do think it is shut with the Ja Morant hopes of, you know, leading the Grizzlies to a championship. Not going to happen, especially given his decline. Not happening when your power forward, Jaren Jackson, rebounds like a little guard. Like, there's just some fundamental issues with this team, Jason, that I think they're ultimately better off looking in the mirror and saying, okay, can we find a team that is going to overwhelm us for Jaren Jackson? That's going to make an acceptable offer for Ja Morant. I'd be open to those things if I'm Grizzlies general manager Zach Kleiman. Is that going to happen? I don't know, because, you know, for Jaren Jackson, I'm sure, like, if he were available, there'd be a vast market for him. Maybe you don't want to trade him, but it'd be an overwhelming offer, I would think, for him. For Ja, I don't know, man. Like, there's A, not a lot of teams that need point guards. There's also not a lot of teams that need a smaller guard on a max contract with a declining game and a bad off-court attitude. I just don't see a wide market unless it's like some middling team that wants to roll the dice, like the Kings, the Pelicans. Like, he just feels like a King or a Pelican to me. I just can't think, like, people have thrown out, well, what about Minnesota? Why would Minnesota trade for Ja? I just see friction between him and Ant personally. I don't think that fit would work. I want the ball in Ant's hands more in the years to come, not less, as he grows as a playmaker. Teams in the Eastern Conference, you mentioned, like, in theory, the Celtics surrounding him with shooting. I agree, that makes some sense. But, you know, they wouldn't want him for personality reasons. Like, who else in the East? Like, not a lot of teams need a point guard. I don't think the Bucks would make any sense. It would not work with Giannis Antetokounmpo. And plus, Ryan Rollins looks excellent. You want to move forward with him. The Heat, well, he didn't like playing last year in the Taylor Jenkins offense with Noah LaRoche and all the qualities they installed there, with not a lot of pick and roll, not a lot of screening, a lot of off-ball motion. He hated that. That's one of the reasons why Taylor Jenkins got let go. So you're telling me he's going to go to Miami where they hired Noah LaRoche as a consultant running a very similar offense? I don't think Miami makes a lot of sense. So I don't know. Unless it's a team like the Nets, but they're tanking their asses off. They just drafted a ton of point guards. I just don't see more than 2, 3, or 4 teams that you could make a strong argument for Ja and have incentive to trade for him. And so that means, like, Memphis might just be stuck with him, and you got to try to make it work. So I'm not going all the way of blow it up, because I think that option might not even be there with Ja Morant. And that's the real panic that I have, that what if there's nobody that makes sense as an out here for us, and we're just stuck in the middle. And that's that. Like, that's really the worst place to be, ultimately.
Yeah, you can't be the guy who has the ball in his hands all the time and is spamming high pick and roll and just playing that heliocentric style unless you are transcendently great, right? Like, it's one thing if it's Luka Doncic and you're like, we're running this many pick and rolls a game and that sort of thing. And that's the thing, is like, they try, like, you, to your point, they did get rid of Taylor Jenkins, and they did kind of go back to, let's just give Ja the ball a ton to end last season. And he did average 27 points per game over his final, I think, 22 games, if I remember correctly. And they were a 500 team, because it's just that type of basketball where Ja just gets the ball and gets to put up numbers. They don't actually win when they play that way. As a matter of fact, when they were playing the Taylor Jenkins driving kick style early in the year and Ja wasn't leading the team in scoring, that was when they were racking up the wins. And so that was the frustrating thing with the Isalo quotes from the story from Shams about that suspension. It's like, okay, so you're clearly upset because Isalo is trying to get you guys to play with ball and player movement. Every smart coach in the entire NBA is trying to find ways to weaponize your talents in a way that cultivates the success of 5-man units. And everyone's chasing these things: more in transition, more ball and player movement, better spacing, all these, like getting the ball at the four quickly so you can get into multiple actions in the same possession. That's literally why Miami's doing all the stuff they're doing. They're looking at what Indiana did, and like in how you can win basketball games by playing super fast and by playing as a team and driving and kicking and all these kinds of things. And it's like, you're upset that this guy as a competitor, as your coach, is trying to cultivate this for you as well, but it doesn't fit your perfect view of Ja Morant dancing with the basketball every single possession down the floor and doing his own thing. And it just, it's pouting. It lacks self-awareness. It's just been really sad because, again, like, I am such a big believer in his foundational skill.
Yeah. Well, I mean, ultimately it's unfortunate to see that foundation crumbling. And I hope by the end of the year, Ja Morant looks like a top 15, 20 player again, but I got my doubts. Now let's move on to a team that I'm sure you're going to be pressing the panic button here. I'd be shocked otherwise. The New Orleans Pelicans. 0-6 so far on the year. They are 27th in the NBA in offensive rating, 106.8. They were 29th in the NBA in defensive rating, 124.2. And they're last in the NBA in net rating, -17.4. Jason, this is the team that on draft night, after trading the Pacers 2026 pick away for the 2025 Pacers pick during the finals before Tyrese Haliburton ruptured Achilles, they then traded that pick to move up 10 spots for Derek Queen. And he doesn't play until the fourth quarter in Sunday's loss they had. And ultimately, this team looks like they've just quit. Looks like they've quit on their coach, Willie Green. It looks like they've quit on each other. So this Pelicans front office, Jason, they have a decision to make with Willie Green. If you're Willie Green, you're panicking for sure, I'm guessing. The Pelicans overall as a franchise, are you being patient with them? Are you panicking with them? Where are you at, Jason? I feel like I would be shocked if you say anything about panic here. Tell me, are you panicking?
You were kind to leave out the DeJounte Murray trade too. Like, it's just been a brutal sequence of events over the course of the last few years. I definitely panic. It'll be a shame if like Willie Green is effectively scapegoated because this roster is broken in so many different ways. Like they're shooting 32% on unguarded.
One quick thing here. You said scapegoating with him. Do you think that's fair to say he would be a scapegoat, or do you think he has some deficiencies as a head coach that would give good reason for the franchise to move on from him at this point? It is a new front office. Do they have good reason to move on from Willie Green, or do you think he would be a scapegoat and that's that?
It's more just one of those things where like their hands are kind of tied in a lot of ways with some of the personnel that they have in house, and so like you got to change one of the two things. And I wouldn't be, they're clearly, to the point you made earlier, they're clearly not bought into Willie Green anymore. They clearly have quit on him, and so if that's the case, you've got to have a change of voice. And at the very least, you've got to attempt to get somebody in there that can galvanize them and get them to play some better basketball. But at the same time, like it's kind of the same thing we're talking about with Ja. Like you've got this downhill guy that can't shoot, but that is a very good playmaker and short range shot maker. And you've surrounded him with a complete lack of shooting. The Jordan Poole experiment, it's early and this could easily turn around, but he's having a brutal start. He's below 50% on the rim. He's not at the rim. He's making nothing off the dribble. He's shooting just 26% on pull-up threes, on floaters and middies. He's 6-for-13. Like you're getting nothing out of Jordan Poole. Trey Murphy's off to a rough start to start the season. None of you made the point about Derek Queen. None of their young guys look exceptionally explosive or talented. Was Zion off the floor this year? I found this out this morning. This is crazy. With Zion off the floor this year, they're getting outscored by 28 points per 100 possessions. Just getting absolutely steamrolled when when Zion's off the floor. And so, like, it's kind of a broken fundamental concept because you've got this big downhill rim pressuring playmaker and you haven't surrounded him with shooting. And down the roster, you don't have any young talent to be excited about. The team's not competing on defense.
Jeremiah Fears. Jeremiah Fears, that's like the one silver lining.
Like, yeah, he's been okay. Yeah. He hasn't been earth shattering.
It's a low bar. It's a one thing to feel. It's a very low bar. It's like, hey, at least we have Jeremiah Fears, who could be a spark plug scorer and hopefully much more. But yes, it's a very, very low bar to your point.
Yeah, it's early, but it's depressing. And like I kind of look at it as like there's a kind of a fundamental broken team construct here, and like it could theoretically come together if all these guys start shooting better, but then you have the same issue on defense. It's just It's dark times down in New Orleans. I feel really there. Here's a question for you. Who's had a worse go of it over the last couple of years, the Dallas Mavericks fans or the New Orleans Pelicans fans?
I mean, I think Dallas, because they actually had the guy and they lost the guy and Luka. But at the same time, at least you had a love. It's better to love and loss than to never love.
Yeah. Right?
the Pelicans have never had anything. It's just pure loneliness.
They were like fun and spunky and exciting a couple years ago. And it's just gone.
I know. It's just insane. I mean, the fact, like, if Joe Dumars could go back in time to the middle of the finals, he would never have had traded the Pacers pick next year for the one this year. And he never would have traded that pick they received and their own pick in 2026 to move up for Derek Queen. And that's also unfair to Derek Queen as well, because Derek Queen, he could be a good player. He could be. It could turn out that Derek Queen ends up a good player long term. But when the Pelicans don't have at the end, there's no light at the end of the tunnel this season. Like, this team could lose or win only 20 games or win only 10 games. Who knows what their record's going to end up being in the crowded Western Conference. But there's no light at the end of the tunnel where on lottery night in the middle of May, you're hoping those balls bounce your way, because the Hawks have that pick. The Hawks have the Pelicans' 2026 first-round draft pick unprotected. And they gave that up to move up 10 spots for a guy who didn't even play until the fourth quarter on Sunday. It just feels like an organization that lacks alignment. It feels like, if you want to be a conspiracy theorist, you could be like, oh, is this like in the movie Major League, where like they tried to move the team from Cleveland to Miami with low attendance? Like you could be a conspiracy theorist if you want to. If Joe Dumars is a plant, you can be that if you want to, because that's how bad it looks. It's like something out of a movie. They traded their own first-round pick unprotected to move up for Derek Queen. And even the Pacers trade, like, I kind of forgot. I was looking at this recently, but when they did that trade, Jason, Haliburton had the calf injury at the time. He hadn't yet ruptured his Achilles, but he had an injury. And so there's just no reason to do that trade when we know what calf injuries can lead to. Everybody was talking about the possibility of the injury before it happened because of the history of this. And yet they did that trade anyway. It's just, I just feel so bad for Pelicans fans, man. It's just awful. But circling back to Willie Green, with Trey Murphy specifically, he's off to a slow start, as you said. But I still think with Willie Green, one of the things that has always bugged me with him is the usage of Trey Murphy. Like, Trey Murphy should not be 28th in the NBA in three-point attempts per game. Trey Murphy is a way better, more dynamic shooter than that. He's been one of the best in the NBA since he entered the league. If Dylan Brooks can get 10 three-pointers per game, Trey Murphy can get 10 three-pointers per game. Like, let's get Trey Murphy more usage, more opportunity. And even with Zion, I think there's a lack of, and this is in part his own limitations. He does not do anything 5 feet or more away from the basket, in part because of his unwillingness. When I interviewed Zion years ago, I asked him, why do you not just take shots? Why don't you take pull-ups? And he said to me, he's like, it's a confidence thing. I lose my confidence when I miss a shot. So I don't know if he's still wired that way. That was, I think, 2 or 3 years ago. I forget exactly when him and I sat down at the gym at UCLA and had that interview. But ultimately, I think it's probably still the case. And so unless he's spacing the floor, that limits what he can do. With that said, I do think there's a lack of creative actions that Willie Green uses with Zion to get him going towards the basket. And ultimately, I think they are going to let go of Willie Green at some point this month or this week or at some point this season. And that's just pure speculation, nothing reported at all, just to be clear. But ultimately, I don't, to your point as well, I don't know if the roster has the pieces for the X's and O's to work, no matter who the coach is. But I do think there's little things. They should not be this bad, Jason. They should not be.
That's what I was just going to say. They shouldn't be this bad on offense. Like when you have this many high level offensive players that are getting off to a rough start, it can't just be everyone's out of rhythm at the same time. There's got to be some organizational issue.
Exactly. Let's move on to the Knicks. They're 3-3 so far this season. Entered the season, of course, with title hopes. Still have title hopes. They took down the undefeated Chicago Bulls on Sunday, but they are 3-3 on the year. Cat's been up and down defensively so far this year, had confusion over his role ahead of opening night. And Josh Hart has a weird hand injury at this point, reported by James Edwards over at The Athletic. At The Athletic. Over the weekend, James reported how it's not just a finger injury for Josh Hart, but he has nerve damage throughout his entire shooting hand that have made it hard for him to do even daily tasks. And Josh Hart, he's shooting only 14.3% from three-point range so far this year, 2 of 14 from three. The Knicks still have the second highest finals odds, according to BetMGM, at plus 340, but they do have their concerns. They are 3-3, Jason, so I'm curious. New York's finals hopes, panic or patience?
I'm big time on patience with the Knicks. I'm a big believer that when you make some fundamental changes in play style, that there's going to be growing pains. I think it's been ironic because I feel like in their home games, they've played a little bit more like older versions of the Knicks where they can get a little stagnant, but it almost like feels more familiar for them. And so they can succeed like that. But I think that there's big long-term potential with what they're doing. Like they were 18th in passes made per game last season. They're 5th in passes made per game this season. Jalen Brunson is getting twice as many spot-up opportunities per game as he did last year. He's converting those spot up opportunities at 1.56 points per possession. He's getting more easy shots. He's running a couple fewer ball screens every game, a fewer ISO every single game. He's getting a little bit more support down the roster just through the ball movement, the transition pushes. There is, I think, an idealized version of the Knicks, which capitalizes on all of the aggregate ball handling that they have, and that's able to hit a higher ceiling on offense than they did last year, in the postseason in particular, because I think they were a better regular season offense than people remember. It's just the Jalen Brunson do-everything attack seemed to hit a certain ceiling when it gets repetitive in the postseason over the course of weeks at a time. But I am a big believer that this kind of thing does take time. They have looked, I think, better on defense than they did last year, just in terms of their overall level of engagement and the intensity of their rotations. Mikal Bridges is off to a better start defensively than he was last year. I think getting Mitchell Robinson back will be key, because I was all before the season, I was like, oh, Mitch is going to be here. It's going to be a completely different team than they were to start last year. And then he's immediately out of the lineup again. But overall, I like a lot of what they're doing. I like the way the bench group is playing, where you've got, you know, Tyler Colette coming in and running just action and making easy reads at the beginning of possessions to get them into rotation. And Jordan Clarkson had a little bit of a rough start, but he's like gunning in transition, shooting crazy pull-up threes and bringing some scoring. Landry Shamet's shooting the ball really well. Like, they've got a lot of things that are going well. It's just very clear that Cat is the guy that is struggling most with the transition to the new style on offense. And so I think that sort of thing's just going to come along in time. Again, like, that's such a substantial increase in their ball and player movement year over year. Give them a chance to kind of find their rhythm, and they should be better. I should admit, I personally have never been very high on the Knicks, not in the past, even not now with the new system. So you're not going to get me to come up here and be like, oh, this is a team destined to hoist the trophy or anything like that. But I do think if you look at their season last year, outside of the 4 wins against Boston, they were generally underwhelming throughout the entire season. Do I think they can be better than that? Absolutely. I think they can look more like a good team that has some good wins against good teams throughout the season, that doesn't struggle as much in a first round matchup as they did last year, that has more highs. I think they're capable of being better than they were last year, even if I'm not as high on them as other people are.
I think that is spot on, Jason. I'm going to be patient with the Knicks. Not going to panic. It's just 3-3. It's just 6 games. This is a new system, new identity. You need to give that team time to figure things out. We got one more category to go, the lineup lab. So let's move on to the first one in that group, and that is the Atlanta Hawks. Trae Young is going to miss 4 weeks with a sprained MCL, and the Atlanta Hawks already lost on Sunday, their first game without Trae. But so far this season, they've done pretty well statistically without Trae Young. With Trae Young on the floor, they're posting a 114 offensive rating and a 123.2 defensive rating. So that's a minus 9.2 net. And then with Trae off the floor. Their offense is worse, 108.5 offensive rating, but their defense is dramatically better, a 107.5 defensive rating, a plus one net rating. Small samples, of course, still, but how do you expect the Hawks to perform these next 4 weeks without Trae Young?
So, first of all, I was just generally disappointed in the Hawks to start the season, even when Trae was on the floor. Yeah. And, like, I get it. Like, Trey's not a good defender. And Trae, in this season, has had some low lights. And there have been stretches where he's been harmful. But they're not this bad. They shouldn't be this bad on defense when Trae's on the floor. They should be able to play better than they did. So, overall, I was just kind of, like, generally disappointed. That said, like, the version of the team with Trae off the floor is very much a defense to transition team that forces a lot of turnovers and gets up the floor in transition. And so I think it just kind of allows them to essentially just have a higher floor when Trae's off the floor, because there's this kind of general expectation with their athleticism, their ability to force turnovers, and their ability to run. What concerns me is it's just dark times for ball handling once you get off of Trae Young. Like, Kristaps Porzingis has had a good start to the season attacking post-ups, and like, he's doing some damage there. Nikhil Alexander-Walker has been okay in his pick and roll reps, but like, to me, Jalen Johnson is still not a guy that you're going to give the ball in the half court and have him break down a defense. He's very much a transition weapon and an attack with an advantage kind of weapon. And so I think it's just going to be really hard for them to keep things afloat with the utter lack of ball handling. And one of the things that happens, and I think we've seen this a little bit with Phoenix even to start this year, because I was higher on Phoenix's defense to start the year. They've been okay in the half court in particular, but one of the things that happens is when you can't score, it gets discouraging for your defense, and you're constantly playing in transition on defense, and you don't have your defense set as often, and you're not as like locked in and engaged because you don't believe as much in what you're doing because you're not scoring on the other end of the floor. I think it can have a trickle down effect. And so I'm actually, even with the lineup data you presented, I'm a little worried about the Hawks over the course of this month without Trae.
I am too. I think you nailed it with the lack of creation aside from Trae. And I think if Dyson Daniels had more point guardy qualities, you'd feel better. But even Dyson Daniels has been off to a bit of a sluggish start so far this season offensively. But ultimately, it is going to be I think they're going to struggle without Trae. Well, I'll just say that clearly. But I think it's going to be interesting to see how some of these guys perform without him, though. Like, I'm excited to see Jalen Johnson with increased opportunity and more on his plate. I can't wait to see Dyson Daniels tap into some of the stuff with him as a point guard we saw at lower levels. Does that develop by the end of the month? Is Daniels able to do more with the ball in his hands with that increased opportunity? Some of these guys, like even Risacher, those touches are going to trickle down to guys like him who typically play more off ball as a complementary piece. And so that's where I think for the Hawks, maybe it can end up a blessing in disguise by the end of the month, even if you lose a few more games than you would have with Trae, because there's a lot of talent on the roster. Like, there's a lot of good players on this Hawks team, which is why people were so bullish on them entering the season. But I do think they're going to struggle at the end of the day. Let's move on to the Boston Celtics. So I'm looking at lineup data preparing for today's segment, and I see the Celtics pop up. So this season, they had three different starting lineups, but the four guys have started every game, and that is Jaylen Brown, Derek White, Nemanja Kata, and Peyton Pritchard. And those teams, that four so far this season is outscoring opponents by 22.2 points per 100 possessions. They have a 126.1 offensive rating, a 103.9 defensive rating. We're dealing with small samples. The Celtics are 3-4, but I've been impressed by the starters, regardless of that who that fifth guy has been in there, whether it's Hauser or whether it is Gonzalez, whoever it may be, or Josh Minot, who's had some great games for Boston so far. Are the Celtics secretly better than their record indicates, Jason?
I think so. I think, first of all, they should have won the Sixers game. That one they toasted off over the final few possessions. The Rockets game was kind of weird because Houston had like the craziest jump shooting game I've seen from them. I think I had Okogie, Amen Thompson, and Tari Eason at 8 for 12.
Wait. From three. Wait, you mean the opening night Sixers game? Just to be clear,
opening night Sixers game.
Okay, just because I know some people are gonna have
the game where they went to the Halloween game.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because they almost blew that other game, like, too.
Yeah, they handled the Sixers up until the end. Yeah, obviously that game was crazy too. But the game on opening night, they kind of like were spamming that Jaylen Brown high post up, and he just had a couple of bad possessions, and they ended up toasting that game off. But like they had the Houston game, they dealt with some crazy jump shooting disparity. Like Houston just shot. Houston sneaky has shot the ball really well for a team that like has had a lot of question marks surrounding their jump shooting to start the year. But that like they it, and obviously in that game they couldn't score the ball as well. But overall, there's been a lot of things that I think have been strong indicators. Like the group that you mentioned, the starting group, this Pritchard, Derek White, Jaylen Brown group, they run a lot of really smart sets. They get the ball moving side to side, and they do generate good advantages. Nemeas Okeda, I've been like really impressed with him to start the season. He's like been very active on defense and has been flying around all over the place and making things happen. The biggest issue is they can't defensive rebound to save their lives. And I do think that we've seen I think this season in a lot of ways has been a reminder of just how versatile and valuable Jason Tatum was, in the sense that he was a big part of their ability to generate quality jump shots. And they've had to take a lot more like questionable contested jump shots. And I think that's shown in their efficiency. They've dropped from 6th to 21st in overall jump shooting efficiency, according to Synergy. They're also like that defensive rebounding piece we just mentioned, them getting smashed on the glass. That's a big thing that Jason Tatum used to help with. I think that Joe Mazzulla has done a nice job trying to like capitalize on margin with this group. Like he knows that they're limited defensively in the front court, so he's swarming drivers and forcing teams to kick out. They're giving up more threes, but they've been the best paint defense in the league to start the season. And then on the other end of the floor, still generating as many threes as they have. It's just like kind of manufacturing as much advantage and margin as they can with the limitations that they have. And they do have a very strong group of perimeter playmakers. And so like I generally have been impressed by them. I think for Boston in particular, to me, they've looked like what I expected this season. A team that has clear talent deficiencies at key position groups, but that has demonstrated a very strong basketball culture that has given them a chance to compete every single night. And we're learning, right? Like we're getting to see some, like it's very interesting to see Josh Minot kind of just, this big athlete who plays hard and that runs in transition and that can guard the ball a little bit. Like that's a super valuable thing in the context of all these perimeter players. Anfernee Simons, it's like, okay, the pull-up shooting's fun, but he can't really get to the basket. That's been a little bit of an issue in the early part of the season. And so it's kind of like proving to be a little petri dish of like experimenting with what the future version of the Celtics will look like.
Yes, and you mentioned that Houston game, their most recent loss, 128-101 to Houston. In that game, Houston shot 19 of 29 from three, 65.5%. And just going to point out for listeners 2 weeks ago who might have poked fun at me for saying I was going to buy the dip on Reed Shepherd's stock after opening night. He's shooting 44.4%. 5.4 three-pointers per game. Just saying, Reed Shepherd looking a lot better, a lot more comfortable since his stinker of an opening night against the best defense in basketball by far in the Oklahoma City Thunder. OKC makes everybody look bad. The Clippers, this is our last topic here, Jason. The Clippers, one of the things I was most excited to watch so far entering the season was the two big lineups that the Clippers would use. They've actually used it a lot more than I actually anticipated, with John Collins being added, Brook Lopez being added, replacing Ben Simmons, who's not even a five, as their backup bigs. So far this season, Zubats and John Collins have shared the floor for 36 minutes. The Clippers have a plus 7.3 net rating. Brook Lopez and John Collins have shared the floor for 77 minutes. The Clippers have a minus 0.6 net rating, so pretty close to even. Overall, though, with the two big lineups, the Clippers are in the pluses. Really, they've only done Zubats as a solo big. You haven't seen much of just Collins or just Lopez on the floor. But I'm curious, Jason, what have been your early impressions of the Clippers' two big lineups, and how do you think it does change the fortunes of this team potentially moving forward?
Well, it makes it more physically imposing. By the way, one of the things I thought was interesting, I pulled the lineup data from Cleaning the Glass, which filters out garbage time, and they have Zubats and Collins at plus 14 per 100 possessions.
Filtering out garbage time, huh?
There must have been a garbage time stinker in there for that lineup. But anyway, the biggest thing that stood out to me, like just in general, the team has been awesome with John Collins on the floor. And I think part of the thing that has been really good for this particular team is the Clippers have come out a little lethargic to start the season. I think it stems from their stars and kind of trickles down, but they've been a little lethargic, a little bit like not quite as locked in as you would have expected for this veteran team that kind of loaded up over the summer. And what John Collins has brought is like high motor athleticism. Like, he's running his lane in transition constantly. He's rolling hard out of ball screens. He's doing damage as an offensive rebounder. He's just a athletic wrecking ball around the basket. And when you combine that with a team that has the kinds of shot creators they do that attract so much attention, and by the way, this is where the two big piece comes in. Zubats is a monster on the roll. And so when he's going into the basket and when you're trying to keep him off the glass and keep him out of deep seals and you're devoting all this extra attention to him, it opens up these like runways for John Collins to shoot into as an athlete. And he's just having a lot of success there. I think high motor athleticism around super talented offensive players has always been kind of like a market inefficiency in the NBA, because those dudes are never getting paid attention to because of the attention you have to devote to the highly refined offensive players. And so I think John Collins has just kind of been like a clear demonstration of that. High motor athlete that just does a ton of damage at the rim off of the attention the other guys grab in every facet of the game, in the half court, in ball screens, in offensive rebound situations, and in transition.
Jason, thank you so much for joining me today, man. You got any shows coming up? Any concerts you're going to?
You know, I've been looking at the Red Rocks slate. First of all, I was like, oh, because I live in Denver now. So I was like, oh, yeah, like we're by Red Rocks. We're going to go see a show. But like, one, every show at Red Rocks is expensive. Every single one of them. I was like, even for like smaller names. But honestly, I'm just waiting for the right show. We're going to get out there. I would like to go to more shows while I'm living here, but I haven't made it out to one yet. It's been kind of a crazy summer, dude. Like, moving was a huge pain, like a huge, huge pain.
It's tough. It is tough. I've done cross-country moves now, let's say four times. In the last eight years, kind of crazy, but it's so I've gotten good at it at this point. But moving is never easy. Red Rocks, though, boy, I mean, I love the Sphere.
I've never
Sphere
been.
Is always the Sphere is my favorite venue, but Red Rocks is my favorite outdoor venue.
Okay,
Red Rocks is beautiful. You gotta find a night where it's nice weather, and it's just perfect outside, and it's just the best vibes, man. Seeing those rocks on the side of you lit up. The sound there for an outdoor venue is awesome. I saw Mount Joy perform there twice, two nights in a row, I think in 2022 or 2023. I forget the year exactly. But yeah, it's just an unbelievable place. It's like a religious experience. There's just something special in the air at that place. So yeah, find a good show for your first there for sure. I highly, highly recommend going to Red Rocks. For sure.
Have you ever been to the Gorge?
No, I have not.
That one's in Eastern Washington. Those are the two that are on my bucket list that I have to, Red Rocks and the Gorge, because it's like it's right by the Columbia River and it like overlooks the entire Columbia River Valley, but it's kind of similar where it's like the outdoor venue that has just insane views. But those are the two that I'm trying to get out to. But I will definitely get out to a Red Rocks show at some point. Probably gonna wait till the summer, because I've seen some videos of the winter concerts there and they look pretty brutal, but we'll see.
I guess it depends on the artist. You playing much guitar lately? You learning anything right now?
The last couple of weeks, not so much. Obviously, just getting back into the groove. But I sent you a picture, actually. I got my guitar studio set up at home. I'm still trying to figure out all the little bits of artwork that I'm trying to do. But I got my guitar gods all up on the wall to help inspire me every time. And
that's
like,
awesome.
I'm trying to like, I've been having a lot of fun with it. I'm trying to get more like more refined on the technical side of it, which is the more boring side. But it's like stuff that I'm trying to learn. But I would love to make more time for it over the course of the next couple of weeks after we get out of this early season grind.
Yeah, it's tough. It's good. There's only so many things you can have on your list that you do every day. And I'm trying to make guitar one of those things for sure. Jason, thank you so much for joining me today, man. Please let people know where they can find all your stuff.
So YouTube, Hoops Tonight, wherever you get your podcast, Hoops Tonight. And then I'm most active over on Twitter at @_JasonLT. But Kevin, dude, it was great to see you, man. This was a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to next time.
Thank you, Jason.
We'll be right back.
All right, it's time for Draft Class to discuss the 2026 NBA Draft Class. Preview the college basketball season from the Field of 68. Jeff Goodman. Jeff, how are you?
What's up, man? It's been a while. How's life out there?
Life's good. I moved back east. I'm on the East Coast.
Oh, you
now.
Did?
Yeah, I moved back to Massachusetts. Yeah, a little less than a year ago. Yep. We haven't crossed paths in person yet.
What, do you want to shovel snow again? I got out of there. I moved to Charleston because done with those winters. And you're going back?
Yeah, I went back. Yeah, I was tired of L.A. I was tired of the fires and a bunch of other stuff. So I decided to move back to Mass. Who knows? Maybe I'll end up in Carolina at some point. I do definitely love it down there. It's college basketball central as well. So good call by you to head down there.
North Carolina. I'm at in Charleston. Not exactly college basketball central, but at least I'm a 4-hour drive from Tobacco Road, so that helps.
Yes, absolutely. No doubt about that. Well, let's go through some college prospects NBA fans need to know. Looking far ahead here to the 26th draft, of course, college basketball season starting on Monday. The top three, AJ DiBonsa, BYU, Cam Boozer, Duke, Darren Peterson from Kansas. Which of those prospects, Jeff, would you have ranked first? And let's start with whoever that player is.
So I said it 2 years ago. I was on the AU circuit, and I'd seen, AJ for a couple of years, had seen Cam for a couple of years, and it was my first time watching Darren Peterson. He played in the Adidas circuit, so I didn't see quite as much of him. And I saw him probably play 4 or 5 times, and then I remember going up to one high major coach. And I love AJ, and I love Cam. Love them. You're not going to hear me say a bad word about any of these three guys. But I walked over to one high major head coach and I was like, why isn't this kid the number one player in the country? I don't understand, because the difference for me, Boozer, and we'll get into it, I'm sure, but AJ has probably got the highest upside. Boozer plays hard all the time and produces all the time. Peterson is 6'5", 6'6", is a killer, can shoot it, can get to the basket, can make people better, can defend at a high level. He's long. He's athletic. He's smart. He's competitive. He's just got the whole package, where AJ has most of it. Don't get me wrong. He has most of it, Kevin. I worry a little bit at times, like AJ doesn't always come to play. He chirps at the refs at times. But again, I'm nitpicking here. I love all three.
I mean, all three are sensational. I mean, really, like, I think that's why this year's draft in the NBA, you will have teams tanking. Ultimately, with Peterson, to your point, though, 6'5", 6'10 wingspan. And I thought the game he had in the preseason against Louisville, 26 points, 15 shots, 5 steals, 4 boards, 2 assists. Like, it just showed kind of the whole complete package of what we could see throughout this entire season from him, where, like, he had a sequence where he hit a 3 off a screen going to his right, like just stopped in a dime, popped, nailed the shot, all net. Then on defense, he stuck to his man through a screen, deflected the pass, got a steal, got the ball, and then hit a pull-up 3 from NBA range, all in a matter of like 30, 35 seconds. And it's like, okay, that if you just see one clip of a player, you'd be like, okay, this guy is going to be an NBA player. And then you watch him over and over and over, and you learn he's also a dog. He always brings it on defense. He's a playmaker. He's a creator. He's an elite shooter. It's like, okay, that's why this guy is getting some of the elite comparisons that he is.
Bill Self has said it. He's the most talented player he's ever coached.
That's high
Last
praise.
I checked, he coached Joel Embiid at Kansas. He coached Andrew Wiggins, who was super talented, supremely talented, but I was probably
Maple Jordan,
critic.
Jeff. Maple Jordan.
Yeah, I mean, he was just he played to the level of his competition way too often.
Oh, yeah.
Took too many nights off. But yeah, this kid doesn't really take nights off. The big question with Peterson is there gonna be too much on his plate? Like, he's gonna be the best combination of, productive player and talent Bill Self has ever had. But the question is, does he have enough around him to take this Kansas team to a Final Four, to make them where they're top 10? Or they just don't have a lot of shooters around him or the highest level talent. They got a freshman in, this kid, Cole Rosario, that they got in, reclassed freshman, who's big and strong and can shoot it. He'll help, but it's not the most talented Kansas team around Peterson.
Now, do you think from an NBA draft standpoint, that's something that when you talk to NBA teams, they'd be, you know, concerned about if Kansas isn't winning at the level? No, not one bit.
No, not at all. Zero. Zero. In fact, I think in a way, teams already know that. So Peterson's fortunate in that, like, sometimes you want those lower expectations. And I think he'll overachieve. And people understand that, you know, this team isn't set up to win a national title. So if somehow they go to a Final Four, it'll give them even more value in terms of, you know, a winning type player, which I think he is. I think he's, I mean, again, like, that dude just comes to play. And he doesn't give a shit about the other stuff, Kevin. Like, he does. Now, on the level of 1 to 3 of not giving a you-know-what about the other stuff, I would say Cam Boozer's among the elite I've ever been around of just being focused on winning and the right things. Like Cooper Flagg was like that too. They're similar. Like Cooper didn't do a one-on-one interview all year during the season last year. Cam won't be that because that was like agent driven too. But Cam just doesn't care. Doesn't say much. Kind of vanilla. Just wants to play ball and win games. And that's, listen, there's a reason. And I'm sorry, I'm going to get onto the Cam Boozer thing already here, but
feel free.
There's a reason I'm picking Duke to win it all this year, and it is Cam Boozer, period. The dude does not lose.
Did you see the clip of him and during a preseason game at halftime, getting his team going? It's like, dude, it's preseason, and I'm getting fired up watching this clip of a teenager getting his team going. It's really no wonder that Cam Boozer won a national title every single year in college, a state championship, right?
Yeah, and at Peach Jam, which is the preeminent summer event, the one that everybody goes to, the one that kids cry when they lose at. So it's not this normal AU event. And he won it all three times. And, you know, two of them came against Cooper Flagg's team.
It's insane. I mean, look, I think with Boozer, most people you talk to have him third behind DiBonsa and Peter DeSai. I think that's purely an upside, you know, ranking. I think what a lot of people would say it that way. But Boozer, 6'9", 7-foot wingspan. We saw in his best game in the exhibition phase for Duke, 24 points, 23 boards, 6 assists. I feel like with Boozer, one of the things that people say about him entering the season is, well, DiBonsa and Peterson are clearly offensive initiators. They're creators. They're bucket getters. Boozer isn't that. But do you think Boozer's creation is a little bit understated, because you see him with pull-ups, the post-ups, the quickness, the fluidity? I feel like maybe there's more there than people are giving him credit for. Would you agree there, or do you think that they're the people who do say he's below those other guys are in the right?
They're in the right, but I'll say this, he's really expanded his game, you know, since I first saw him 3 years ago. Now he can step out, he, you know, slowly kind of every year I saw him, it was, okay, he was more of a low post guy at 15. At 16, he was able to kind of step out and make him from, you know, 15, 17. And this past summer, you know, a year ago, he was able to really shoot the ball from three at a pretty good clip. So whatever you need him to do, he's not a great athlete, but he's super cerebral. He's always in the right place defensively. You know, I compare him a little bit, again, like a Cooper Flag in terms of how he approaches the game. A Tim Duncan, not in terms of his game necessarily, but like the methodical, you know, fundamental way that Tim Duncan was. And again, he wasn't a guy that was flashy, not on the court, not off the court. Cam Boozer's similar.
Is it possible that people are just overthinking it in that sense with Boozer, that he is actually the best prospect in this class? Like, he's just a guy who's won at literally every single level, every single competition. Isn't it possible, like, even though he doesn't have these star, you know, the size, the big wing of AJ DiBonsa, or the dynamic scoring of Darren Peterson, that actually Cam Boozer at 6'9 with a 7-foot wingspan is just going to be one of those classic fours who's just part of a winning team for every single year of his NBA career, and he ends up the best player in the class? Like, isn't there a chance of that?
Yes. No, there's a chance he averages 20 and 10 at Duke. There's a chance he averages 20 and 10 in the NBA, and it wouldn't shock me at all. Again, you know, so many people are blown away by what the multidimensional wing, right? You know, that's AJ. AJ, you'd look at him and you're like, holy crap, like what he could be. You know, Darren Peterson, same thing. The guy that you put the ball in his hands and just say, hey, you know, he can make a play no matter what for himself and for others. Boozer's different. And that's why I think he ultimately doesn't go number one, but I think he could go number two. And I think he could be the, you know, he's the safest. He's the safest pick of the three. You know what you're going to get out of him. But again, I would agree to the critics that would say, like, his upside isn't quite as high as those other two guys.
I think it's a fair thing to say. I mean, especially given what you said about Peterson and then with AJ DiBonsi, 6'9", 7'1" wingspan. He's a very talented offensive creator. With AJ, what do you like about his game and what are some of the things that you need to see him get better at to become the number one guy come next June?
I mean, his length, his athleticism, his tenacity, his ability to, again, be that guy who can do everything, right? Like, he can score in every way possible. He can be a menace defensively because of his length, because of his athleticism. You know, a Paul George-type player, but I think mentally tougher than Paul George ever was. And, I mean, maybe that's not saying a ton. Well,
that was the funny thing about what Kevin Young said to your writer at the Field of 68, Sam Lance. He said, you know, Paul George comes to mind as like a guy with a two-way ability that he's asking AJ to be this year. But I agree. Like, the mindset is just opposite ends of the spectrum. No, disrespect to Paul George. No disrespect. Right. But AJ DiBonsa, he's from Brockton. I'm from Brockton. I know the type. I mean, he's an MF-er is what AJ can be on the court.
Yeah, and you know, his dad is from Brockton and pushes him hard. But AJ's also super smart. All three of them are, really. All three of them. You know, I've gotten a chance to know all three of them. Boozer, like I said, doesn't say a whole lot. But again, they're different personalities, but I think they're all high character guys. You know, to me, I think the biggest thing for AJ is just the consistency in his three-point shot. That's the biggest thing that I worry about. But again, with a lot of those guys, I mean, if you had ever told me that Jaylen Brown would be I know he didn't shoot great last year from three, but would be what he's been in the NBA in terms of an above average 37% three-point shooter, I would have said no way back at Cal. Or in high school when I saw him on the AU circuit. So I think DiBonsa works. I mean, they're all workers too. Like I said, you can't nitpick at these three. You can't even do it, Kevin. Like, I hope people don't start to do it during the season.
No, people will do it. People are going to do it.
I know. They're gonna do it. I know. All I'll say is, like, tank. Like, the Chicago Bulls, like, you're doing it all wrong right now. You're doing it all wrong.
You think it's that type of year where even some of these teams, yes. And we're recording
the
this
Celtics.
On. Yes. Well, as we're recording this, for what it's worth, as we're recording, the Bulls are 4-0. The Celtics are 2-3 right now. That's too many wins is what you're saying, yes. for these teams.
Hell yeah. Like, you don't think Brad Stevens wants this year to be about, okay, let me build up some trade value with some of these guys, right? Simons and whatever else he can. I don't know what else he can do, but. But, yeah, you want a Derek White, a Jaylen Brown to have minor injuries to whereas they're out 2-3 weeks, and then you look up at the break and you're 15 games under 500, and you're like, maybe we can get in the mix here and be the next Dallas Mavericks and get lucky in the lottery.
And with Dallas, they had the 11th best odds, and then they moved up. So you don't need to be – a 17-win team. You could be a 32-win team or a 28-win team.
And get in the top five.
Yes.
I'm not even – like, we've talked about three guys, Kevin, so far. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you, this draft is about way more than three guys. There's some other guys here that would have went number two or three, maybe two, even ahead of Dylan Harper a year ago, that are going to go 5, 6, 7 this year.
All right, well, let's move on to some of those guys here because I want to ask you about who's the lottery prospect that's not getting enough attention?
Probably Mikal Bronson Jr. You know, I think he's just kind of fallen off lately because of these other three guys. And because Louisville's going to have so much around him, Kevin, they brought in, and this is a kid that was the MVP for the U.S. team that AJ was on. Or actually, he wasn't. I'm sorry. He lost out. He should have been the MVP. AJ got it. Mikel Brown deserved it. Freshman at Louisville, was a small point guard a few years ago and has grown. He's now 6'4". He's long. He can shoot it from 30 feet. I've seen him in workouts. I mean, he can really shoot the ball.
And against Bucknell in their preseason game, nasty, just pull up at the end of the first half.
He might be, as much as I just told you, like the three kids off the court are awesome. I'm not sure I've been blown away by a kid speaking to him for 30 minutes like I did a couple months ago with Mikel Brown, a freshman, a kid his age. And his dad works him. This is a relentless worker who, again, has gotten better, still figuring out his body. And that's one of those things where in the past he was small, so he would use the floater game and understand he couldn't finish through contact. Well, now he's 6'4", so he's trying to get adjusted to this now that, hey, I'm athletic now too. I wasn't that athletic. I can dunk on dudes now. So it's still a process for Mikel. He's not going to put up the numbers of any of the other three scoring because Louisville's got a lot of dudes, and they brought in two or three guys, veteran guards that are elite shooters, and Ryan Conwell, Isaac McNeely, Adrian Woolley. So he could average 13 a game, 12, 13 a game, and 6 or 7 assists. And I still would say, like, okay, I think he could be the number 4 pick.
Now, with like Brown and guys like Nate Amend at Tennessee, among others in this year's class, it feels like the tiers are the top three we're talking about with Boozer, DiBonsa, and Peterson, and then a bunch of others. Do you see any world in which anybody breaks through and surpasses anybody in that top three?
I mean, I guess Amend could just because of potential. You know, I mean, he's not as long as Kevin Durant, but he, you know, 6'10", he's long, he's thin. He's not going to put up the numbers, you know, physically, but I think he had one game on, you know, 25 points and 25 rebounds. He's tougher than he looks, but it's going to take him some time at Tennessee to get going. Could he? Yeah, like he could if an NBA team looks at him and says, hey, the potential is there down the road. Same thing with Mikel Brown. Like, you look at him and the potential is there for him too. But I think right now you're talking about a pretty clear-cut top three. And then, like you said, a next tier that those two are in, Caleb Wilson from North Carolina. He's got to be in there.
The Wilson-DiBonsa battle, yeah. BYU versus UNC. Sometimes it felt like those guys, oh, wait a minute. It's like kind of the Spider-Man meme, right? Where it's like, I don't often go against somebody with all this size, length, versatility, and athleticism.
Yeah, they look similar, right? They are. They're both, you know, 6'9", super athletic. You know, AJ's game's a little more refined,
yes,
I think, than Caleb's is. But Caleb's also already an elite defender, where AJ needs to put his mind towards, as you said, you know, when reading the story from the quotes from Kevin Young, he needs to put his mind towards being that. Same thing with Peterson. Like, it's hard. I mean, a lot of these freshmen, right, they're not used to, you know, dominating the game of the defensive end. But now I think all these guys have the ability to be really, really good defenders.
Who's your favorite senior first rounder? Bennett Sturts, maybe?
Oh, yeah, that's my guy. Yeah. I keep forgetting Bennett is a senior now. So last year in Charleston, Drake played here and came in with a bunch of kids, like D2 kids, right, that their coach had brought up, Ben McCollum had brought with him from the D2 ranks. And I fell in love with Bennett Sturts right away. Big guard, big point guard, 6'4". Talk about a kid who knows how to play, man. Like, this kid is just cerebral, does whatever you tell him to do, can shoot it, can get in the paint, can guard. He's not the most athletic dude in the world, but he went from, like, I'm not kidding when I tell you, like, not on anybody's list ever to now where he might have been able to go and be a first-round pick last year. The coolest part is, so he calls me when his coach went to Iowa, goes from Drake to Iowa, and he goes in the portal like every kid does when their coach changes their job, pretty much. You just put your name in the portal, and he calls me, and he's like, hey, just want to let you know I'm going with Mac. I'm going with my coach to Iowa. And I'm like, oh, you know, you're putting out a huge graphic. You're making an announcement like every kid does now, right? Like every kid, it's got to be done just right, and they got to get the attention. And he's like, no. He's like, just tweet it out. I don't care. Whatever you want to do. And he made, Kevin, I'm telling you, he could have made $3.5 million on the open market.
Really?
And I bet you he didn't even make $1.5 million from Iowa. But he understands like the value of loyalty and also the value of playing in a system. And Ben McCollum taking a chance on him when he had no Division I offers coming out of high school, but also like how this system really suits his game. You know, he's not necessarily a breakdown guy, but he's big, he's smart, high IQ, great passer, can shoot it, can score from the mid-range, can get to the basket and finish. He's not going to do it and dunk on dudes, but man, I freaking love this kid. Love him.
I think I forget exactly where I had him ranked last year before he officially pulled his name out, which was kind of the expectation that he wouldn't stay in last year's draft class. But with him, it's like the pick and roll feel for the game feels
insane.
NBA level, right? Like yes. He can pull up, he can snake the pick and rolls, get into the mid range, has a little bit of a floater, like a really good floater. So if he's not able to get to the rim, he still has a touch and an ability to weigh like outside the restricted area in the passing. I just can't wait to see him with better quality teammates players around him. And I think from an NBA side of things, it's a higher level of competition. And so teams are going to get to see him against tougher opponents, more NBA caliber or at least international caliber prospects. And that's where you're going to really get a feel. Is this guy a top 10 pick? Is he just a top 20 guy, a late first round pick?
I think he's somewhere in that mix, Kevin. Yeah. I think he's somewhere from 10 to 20 would be my guess right now. And he's also wired kind of like Boozer is. Doesn't say a whole heck of a lot, but man, that kid just wants to win. He'll do anything to win. Like I said, that's part of the beauty of this class is there's not really turds at the top of it. You know, sometimes you'll find some, but sometimes you will, and it's hard to talk around that.
Yeah.
Like with this group, there's none of those. Like they are, like I just can't wait to see them in. And there's been the last few years, the freshman classes have sucked for the most part. I mean, I know we had Cooper last year, but let's face it, like Ace Bailey didn't do a lot for me. 2 years ago, the class was awful. This year, like we've waited for this type of class for a few years.
It's a potential all-timer class is what it really is with those guys up top. And one other guy I think that could be a potential response to that kind of category of favorite senior prospects is Yaxel Lendenborg at Michigan. I mean, he's transferring from UAB. It's going to be very, very interesting to see what he does, kind of replacing Danny Wolf, who had a big year after transferring there from Yale, becomes a pick for the Brooklyn Nets in the late first round, and we'll see how his rookie season goes with Brooklyn. But with Lendenborg, like, the dude's probably going to put up massive numbers. I wouldn't expect that to change. Like, last year at UAB, he's, like, putting up 30 and 15 in one night and 28 and 12 the next night. It was, like, some massive numbers from him. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about his game?
Well, I'm going to tell you first about his background, and you probably don't even know this. He played 10 high school games in his career, 10 high school games. Came from a tough family, had to take care of his younger siblings, has, I think, 5 younger sisters, he told me, and just didn't go to school, didn't care about going to school.
Played video games, right? Like that's what he did a lot. He was like a big gamer, if I remember correctly,
yes,
right?
Yes. Just sat home and like didn't do anything. And then his mom told him, she's like, you're going to Arizona Western. And he's like, no, I don't want to go. And he started crying. And next thing you know, he's in Yuma, Arizona for a couple of years playing junior college ball. Commits to St. John's, like becomes a really good player. Said he was terrible when he first got there. Commits to St. John's. Mike Anderson gets fired. Goes to UAB. Has a really good year. Could have went in the portal and made a couple million 2 years ago. Never even entertains it. Is again that loyal. And then after this past year, could have been, I don't know what your people were telling you, but I think he would have went like 25 to 40. He wasn't a lock first rounder like some people were saying, but he goes to Michigan. He's going to make $3 million this year. So he is not an exceptional athlete, but a well-rounded, like you said, he's got some of Danny Wolf to his game in terms of the passing ability, an elite level passer, who's an okay shooter, but just kind of a Swiss Army knife type guy who, again, I think plays his way into the first round as a lock late first rounder.
Yeah, I'd say so as well with him. Very interesting prospect. Who's a transfer that has the opportunity to help their draft stock the most this year? Aside from the two of the names we just mentioned with Sturts and Lennonborg.
Jaden Quaintance to me would be the guy. He averaged 10-8 last year at Arizona State. Got $1 million to go to Arizona State last season. The youngest player in the class. So he wasn't even eligible, but he got hurt. He tore his ACL. So he decided to transfer to Kentucky. And this kid is a man child. First of all, he's grown 2 inches since last year. I mean, he's 6'10 now. I saw him in Lexington a month or so ago. He's 6'10, 250, and he looks like a brick house. I mean, he is, but he's skilled. He can pass it. They're going to run their offense, a lot of it through him. Mark Pope will, when he becomes cleared to get back on the court. They're not going to rush him. So I don't think he even plays the first few weeks. But this is a kid that, again, you're talking about being a top 10 pick this year, and he's on a Kentucky team that is absolutely loaded. So he's not going to put up crazy, crazy numbers, I don't think. But, he'll block shots. He's an elite level rebounder. He's an exceptional athlete. He is big, strong, tough, and doesn't drink, doesn't smoke, doesn't party, doesn't do anything. So another one to add to the list of great kids.
Do you think we're going to see him by November 18th for the Champions Classic in New York, which the game I will be there?
I don't know. I'm going to be there too. I hope so. Pope said that when we were there, he's well ahead of schedule. I just wonder, you don't want to put him out there. That you don't want that to be his first game. Not there. He better get one before that if he's going to play in that. I would think he plays. I just don't think you're going to see the real Jaden Quaintance. I think you're going to walk away being okay, he played 10, 12 minutes. He didn't do a whole lot. I got to wait and see what he's like in January and February.
Yeah, I think so as well. Somebody to be very, very patient with. Who's this year's Cedric Coward? The kind of the no name, unknown, nobody's thinking about him, except for the real draft junkies. And then becomes a lottery pick or a mid-first rounder. So who's this year's Cedric Coward?
So I just saw him the other day. Just talked to him. Tyrone Riley of San Francisco. He's 6'5", 6'6", long, averaged about 10 points a game last year, an elite defender, long, athletic, can guard, lefty, gets after it, plays hard, huge upside, not a great shooter yet, but I think that part of his game will probably make a jump this year. But he's a guy that the NBA teams, 15 NBA teams have already been through San Francisco this preseason. So they know all about him. They're aware. He's a guy that probably right now, I would say he'll be the mid-major guy who has a chance to be a lottery pick.
Interesting. And with a guy like him, why not transfer? Is there any reason he stayed at San Francisco that you've understood?
I mean, he's from out that way, but no, I mean, it is crazy because those kids, they can go in the portal and I don't know what he made this year, but that's a kid that probably could have made, three times as much money if he had gone to, high majors were aware of him. But some of these kids understand that maybe they weren't highly recruited, like Sturts coming out, and there's some loyalty with some of them. And he also realizes, hey, you know what? If the NBA guys are on me already, well, that means I'm doing something right here. And they get the understanding that, for Bennett Sturts especially, okay, yes, you might have gone somewhere else and made more money this year, $3.5 million. But if you're going to the wrong system, does it hurt you? And then you fall out of, you're not a first round pick and you never see a second contract in the NBA. So you know the investment, right? The investment of these teams, if you are a first round pick, is very different than you fall out of the first round. So I think for some of these kids, their agents are giving them good advice, which is, hey, you know what? It worked with you in this spot or with this coach. You know, be careful. The grass isn't always greener on the other side.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately, San Francisco is going to face Santa Clara twice this season, and Santa Clara had featured Jalen Williams, who just won an NBA Finals and has become one of the top 20, 25 players in the NBA. And he was a lottery pick. You don't need to be at a Kentucky, a Duke, one of these big name schools in order to get the attention of NBA scouts and GMs nowadays. You can play at San Francisco and scouts will come to you and learn everything they got to know and still take a risk on you in the middle of the first round. You don't have to leave. So it's really about where you're comfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, again, I think there's something to be said for that in this day and age where most kids are taking the money. It's kind of cool to see that, you know, some are, and again, staying loyal might be the wrong word, but just understanding the value of like, hey, it's working out for me. I'm not going to screw this up.
I mean, it's just so funny talking about it this way, how much things have changed with college basketball, with transfer portal and talking about guys could get offered triple at different schools. What a different world, Toppin, Jeff.
Think about it. Like AJ is probably going to make, and this is a guess, nobody knows exactly what it's going to be, but when all is said and done this year, AJ DeMonte is probably going to make $6-7 million. Now, this was the year. If there was a year to come out of high school or be in college, it's the year, because rev share comes in next year. We just don't know what things are going to look like. It's going to be harder. Teams are probably going to have to cheat again, where this past year it was just like there were no rules. There were no rules. There was no cap. There was no nothing. So this was the year, you know. I mean, look at Braden Smith, decided to stay at Purdue, and he's going to make great money. Don't get me wrong. He's going to make like $2.5 million. But if he had gotten the portal, like he could have doubled that. Some school, JT Toppin paid Texas Tech $4 million. You're telling me a school wouldn't have paid Braden Smith, the best point guard in the country, you know, $5 million? Probably.
And he'd be making the league minimum in the NBA. That's why these guys are deciding to stay as long as they can in college. Like win at a high level. Hopefully,
well, the international guys, Kevin. Yes. And I know we're not going to talk about this, but you know, it's really changed this year with all these international kids now coming into college. 22-year-olds,
Dame Sarr,
right,
going to Duke.
Yeah, yeah. They're making money. They're making real money. They're making more money to come over here right now. And a lot of the college coaches are like, "Well, why wouldn't I want a 22-year-old?" You know, a kid DeRitter at Virginia, 22 years old. I'll take that. A kid, Sananda Fru, is a German kid, 6'10", who's not a freshman. I think he's deemed a junior at Louisville. Well, like, yeah, if you can do it. But next thing you know, I've said this, I think in a year, LeBron's going to be like, well, why can't I go and play with Bryce James? What rule is going to stop me? I'll sue the NCAA and everybody wins.
Can you imagine that?
It's far-fetched, but not that far-fetched.
I know, really. What's your take on what are you understanding from NBA teams about this? There seems to be a positive feedback in your experience talking to NBA people about this.
They love it because they get a chance to see all these kids here. They don't have to go over, and a lot of these scouts don't, you know, make a ton of trips. Some do. But there's a lot of them that aren't going to go over there multiple times. Now they can see all these kids over here. Now, again, the international crop overseas isn't going to be great this year. That's going to be the difference. But, yeah, I think they're looking at, you know, some of these kids, kid Neo at Virginia Tech, who almost came out after a strong combine. And Mike Young has said, the Virginia Tech head coach has told me, he's like, he's the most talented player I've ever coached. You know, he's kind of like Igor from BYU last year, but a better shooter, 6'9" point guard. So there is a kid that I think to really watch from the international group that could take a jump, because Mike Young, also one of the best coaches and developers in the game. So that kid's going to get a lot better this year.
Jeff, appreciate you so much joining me today, man. Please tell people all about the Field of 68 and where they can find your stuff.
Yeah. So Field of 68, we started up about four or five years ago, Rob Doster and I, and we cover college basketball like nobody else. We have shows every night We have guys like Tyler Hansbrough, Randolph Childress, Matt McCall, myself and Rob. John Fan has been on it. He helped start this thing off. And basically, we cover college hoops like nobody else does, you know, 365 days a year. And we're relentless in how we cover it. So you can follow us. We're on YouTube, Field of 68, the Field of 68 on X, Twitter, Goodman Hoops for me. And good to see you, man. Good to see you.
Likewise,
glad you're back in Boston. Are you? I assume you will also be at the BYU UConn game a couple of days before.
I sure will be at that for sure. Okay. Yeah,
I'll see you both.
Oh, nice. Looking forward to hang out there. Jeff, I appreciate you so much joining me today, man. Thank you. I've always admired how relentless you are and everything you do. Thanks, so Jeff. It's awesome to see Field of 68.
I'm glad for all your success, man. I remember, hey, I remember when you were just breaking in and doing your draft guide, and it's cool to see good people, good hardworking people be rewarded. So I'm glad you're doing well. I still don't know why the hell you'd move back to Boston to do the winners, but to each their own. Family does mean something.
Family. It's home at the end of the day. For now, who knows though what the future brings, it is home. It'll always be home. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you so much for joining. Thank you again to Jason and Jeff for joining me on today's episode. We'll be back again on Thursday with Tom Haverstraw. Thank you to Emmy, Dakota, and Sarah for producing today's episode. Thanks to Father John Misty for the music. Talk to you on Thursday. Have a great week, everybody.